My name is Michael Pellet. I teach systematic theology at the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And this week, the sessions that I will have are on liberation theology. It's an overview of liberation theology, some of the issues and the themes and the concerns of theologies of liberation. And in particular this week, I would like to look at liberation theology from the perspective of Latin America. There are liberation theologies going on all over the world, on the African continent, in Asia. There's a book now on a Palestinian liberation theology. The strand or the trend in a liberation theology that I'm the most familiar with and have looked at closely is from Latin America. And so that will be the major focus and the major perspective from which I will be speaking about liberation theology this week. But I will try to bring in some information and some comments and perspectives from other areas as well, just so that you can get a flavor, a feel, perhaps an understanding of what is meant by liberation, what is meant by a theology of liberation, that it might provoke your own thinking and your own imagination a little more about what are the implications of this for your understanding of Christianity, the Christian life, the Christian faith, that you can carry some of these themes and issues with you into other presentations and other groups and sessions. And also I hope that during the week we'll be able to talk about it with one another or certainly with me at any time, over coffee or food or whatever. To begin, with regard to the understanding of a theology of liberation, I would like to read a poem, a meditation, a prayer. I guess one would say that it is all of these, written by Reverend Zephania Kamita. And Pastor Kamita is the vice president of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Namibia. And so here we have an African perspective and a South African perspective on a theology of liberation. And his poem is entitled, Why, O Lord? Kamita writes, "You know, Lord, what is going on this moment in the hearts of Toivo Yatoivo, Nelson Mandela, and Aaron Mushimba. Certainly you know the hearts of my brethren, their daily sufferings, far away on the vast and lonely welt among the sheep. You see them despised and neglected, paid a mere trifle. You read their thoughts deep down in the pits where they are slaving for next to nothing. Lord, the many new graves of the children from Soweto are well known to you, and so are the tears of their parents and comrades. You are undeceived by the reasoning and hypocrisy of Turnhall. You have observed the hundreds of prisoners maltreated in the camps of North Namibia. They are cruelly struck with the butt ends of rifles. Cigarettes are put out against their naked bodies. We are miserable and afflicted like the children of Israel in Egypt, and you are aware of it all. Why? Oh, why, Lord? Why do you seem deaf to our doleful cries? Or have you turned your back upon us? How long will you allow them to trample us underfoot? Is our trust nothing to you? Is our hope vain? Why? Why do you keep us waiting? Why? Oh, why, Lord? Why did you create us? Did you make us only to be shot like dogs infected with rabies? Did you make us to be oppressed and put to scorn forever? Why, Lord, why? Are there limits to your love, and are we expelled? Did you make us Kaffirs, Bantus, non-whites? We are doomed to stand humbly at the back door of the boss, receiving a splash of water from a rusty marmalade tin. Did you create us to live on, yeah, boss, and yes, missus? Did you make us the human caricatures of this world? Why? Oh, why, Lord, did you create us? Why did you tell us through your word that we were made in your image? Why this teaching that regardless of language, race, and color, all are equal in your eyes, and that we ought to treat and accept each other as such? Why did you make us realize that our slavery is at an end, that we are liberated men and women bought at a high price with the blood of your only Son? It might have been better if you had let us alone in our blindness. It would have been easier then to submit to our fate. It is impossible now. We have been brought to see for ourselves that we are incomparably more precious than all diamonds from Oranjemund and all uranium from Rossing. Why, Lord, did you open our eyes? Why don't you answer when we cry out to you? How long will you remain passive, looking silently at our agony and our tears? The yoke has become unendurable. We won't carry it one step farther. Why do you allow iniquity and lies to rule over us, you who redeemed us at the cost of your own life? You are King of Kings, and they struck you with their fists and cudgels. They spat upon you to show their utter contempt. Cruel nails pierced your hands and feet. And all this only because of your great and infinite love for us. Why, then, are you now silent? From the depths we call to you. Save us in our distress. Guide us in the right way to Namibia and not to a neo-colonial Southwest Africa. O Lord of the whole world, refresh our souls and make them new. We are consumed with thirst for release, righteousness, redemption, shalom. Fill our callous, empty hands with your good gifts. Crush the copper gates and shatter the iron locks of Robben Island. Break up the prison camps where our brothers and sisters are captive and tortured. Help them, Lord. We call to you. Save us in our deadly fear. We are trembling and feeble. Take our destiny in your strong right hand. Through us, let the world see your wonders. Give us the spirit of life so that we may arise. Then help us to raise unwearyingly under your guidance the beacons of your kingdom in this country. Amen. That haunting question of why. Why are people oppressed, downtrodden, dominated, put under? And most ironically, why are those who are dominated and oppressed by others who call themselves Christian? Why are they dominated and oppressed by us, who may call ourselves Christian and are engaged in this kind of complicity? The background for liberation theology, and to set the background, if you will, for I think some of the context of theology in the last 150 years, And for this, in terms of on the handout sheet, it's what I have under Roman numeral 1, the fundamental question of modern Christian theology. And I have here just a short introduction that I'd like to read to you and reflect on what have been the major questions in theology for the 19th and 20th century. And to start with this, I'd like to go back to 1799, a good year, and the German theologian Friedrich Schleiermacher, a name I'm sure that you tossed around at dinner tonight. And to see how Schleiermacher, who has been called at times the father of modern theology, has set an agenda for theology, particularly for Europe and North America, and an agenda and question for theology which now theologians of liberation are calling into question. And at least this is the way I try to put this together. In 1799 in Berlin, Friedrich Schleiermacher published a book entitled On Religion, Speeches to the Cultured Despisers. The purpose of the book was to show and to convince the cultured, the elite, the philosophical advocates of Immanuel Kant, the literary giants such as Goethe, the romanticists such as Schlegel, that Christianity was essential to the cultured enterprise. That in fact the possibility for any human thinking or doing was grounded in an immediate awareness or consciousness of God. What good is Christianity? Sneered the cultured despisers. Why, it shows us how every human enterprise, even our very consciousness and awareness, ultimately is dependent upon God, was Schleiermacher's response. That book and the reaction to it set one major agenda for the remainder of the 19th century and often for the 20th century as well. What good is Christianity? Asked philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach. His answer? It is merely the projection of human subjectivity as it strives to transcend itself. What good is Christianity? Asked Karl Marx. It is an opiate for the people, used by the bourgeois class to keep the minds of the proletariat focused on otherworldly concerns and hopes, and not focused on the suffering and alienation they undergo due to the ownership and means of production. What good is Christianity? Asked Sigmund Freud. It is a system devised to repress the desires of the human being into the recesses of the subconscious, often leaving one with severe psychological problems and guilt. To every challenge that arose, Christian theologians would counter and often offer their own counterattacks. And so the verbal volleys, the conceptual conflicts, the philosophical forays continue. From the midst of that battle, a group of theologians, mostly from Latin America and mostly in the 60s, emerge, and they ask us all to consider another major question. Why? Because they contend that the question, what good is Christianity, is the wrong question. They contend that we should not be asking what good is Christianity, but rather for whose good is Christianity? For whom does the God of the people of Israel, and for whom is the God who raised Jesus from the dead. Good. Indeed, there is no reason to bother asking what good is Christianity unless we first know whether or not Christianity is for someone's good at all. This question, for whose good is Christianity, then again takes us back to the Scriptures. In searching the Scriptures, these theologians of liberation again find out for whom God was good. One event which stands out showing us God's goodness is the Exodus. Here, God chooses a poor, oppressed people, frees them from bondage to the Egyptians, is with them in their wanderings, and establishes them as a nation. God is a deliverer. A liberator. For whom is God good? The poor and oppressed Hebrew people. Throughout the history of Israel, the voices of the prophets continue to remind the people that God sides with the poor. The widow, the orphan, the traveler, the indentured servant are those for whom God cares. And they are not to be oppressed or exploited by those to whom prosperity has been given. Rather, as God's instruments of peace, justice, love, and deliverance, those prosperous ones are to help the poor in any and every way they can. They are to take the side of the poor, even as God does. In the words of the prophet Micah, what God desires is that we do justice and love kindness and walk humbly with our God. With the coming of Christ, we see again in most dramatic ways for whom God, and certainly following from Christ, for whom Christianity is good. The ministry of Jesus indicates that it is not the Romans, the imperialist conquerors of Judea and the world, who are Jesus' major audience, nor is it the Jewish aristocracy, the Sadducean bankers, merchants, and priests who come clamoring to Jesus, but the poor, the sick, the lame, the dying, and the sinners. And not only do they come clamoring to Jesus, but more importantly, Jesus goes out to them. Indeed, he is accused and categorized as being a friend of sinners. In Luke's gospel, Jesus cites a passage from Isaiah as summarizing his ministry. Quote, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. The Lord has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed." For whose good is God and the Christian message? These theologians of liberation respond. As we read the Scriptures, we see God acting as a liberator of the poor and oppressed. In fact, it seems as if God chooses to be on their side. God prefers them. The theological process then becomes embodied into the process of liberation. Where the poor and oppressed in this world are struggling to be seen, recognized and respected as human persons, there is where the good news of Jesus must be, struggling and suffering with them. Christian theology, liberation theology, becomes a liberating force which tends to contribute to the total understanding of salvation, in total salvation in Jesus, which takes place in the actions of real life. The theology of liberation does not intend to provide Christian justification for positions already taken, And it does not aim to be a revolutionary Christian ideology. On the other hand, this theology of liberation does not pretend to be ethically neutral. In fact, it sees this stance of neutrality as actually part of ruling class ideology. Neutrality is a hidden commitment to the status quo. Liberation theology is advocacy, and advocacy for the poor and oppressed. It is taking the side which God, by preference, has already and always taken. Okay, just two summarizing comments. The major questions and the shift in the question from what good to for whose good. And you can see there that while this wants to look at it in terms of content, right? What good is Christianity? And you can then talk about right beliefs and proper philosophical arguments and so on and so forth. It gets you into the realm and the whole area of what one might call theory. When you ask, for whose good and for whom is God good, this gets one into the realm of action. And reflection then upon that kind of action. This is the realm which has been labeled that of praxis. And they use the Greek term praxis here to indicate that this is more than just application or technique or neat little how-to tricks, but it's a whole action reflection model that entails some content, to be sure, but it is also more than that. It is carrying out and understanding and putting into action what we believe, teach, and confess. In other words, it's the understanding of loving God and loving neighbor. That's at the level of praxis, of action and reflection. That's not just a nice little statement of belief that we simply or merely assent to. The question here is for theologians of liberation, faith is more than just assenting to the right belief propositions. Faith is a trust which puts into action that which we believe. So that's the first key major distinction and major category, I think, that delineates liberation theology from the usual way we may go about and approach theology. Let me stop here and just simply ask if there are any questions or comments. Yes.
If we take in the context of the great, go out to the nations and focus.
Great Commission, Matthew 28.
Mm-hmm. If we say, for whose good then the Great Commission was, could we not also say in that context that there were certain people who knew for whose good Freya and Thor and Odin, they knew who they were good for too. You put Christianity back on a real competitive level.
Yeah.
We just one more competitor rather than someone who says, we are number one.
Yeah. But I think if we're going, you know, to go to the Great Commission, that's a good place to go. We have to remember what the whole Great Commission entails, right? We like to read that passage in Matthew 28 that says, go and make disciples of all nations. Period. But that isn't where Jesus stopped. Right? It's go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them, so on and so forth. And then what? Teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And when we say, well, what has Jesus taught us to observe? What are all the things that Jesus has commanded us? That is the action and praxis side of it. Don't stop with just the theory. Don't stop with just saying, go out there and get those folks to assent to me. And, you know, there's all sorts of ways you can do that. You can cajole them, you can persuade them, you can threaten them. But not, you can't do all of those actions legitimately in terms of a Christian understanding of making disciples when you take into consideration what is the praxis that Jesus advocates as well. What does Jesus teach us? And when Jesus teaches us, love God, love neighbor, forgive, heal, console, say peace be to this house. Right, the gospel lesson for this Sunday. That again, when one reflects upon the kind of action that Jesus calls us to, that is what removes us from that kind of competitive understanding and gives us again the genuinely Christian understanding of what making discipleship and what discipleship in the world is all about. Yes, please. Anyone else? Okay. To look at some of this with this question, for whose good? To take a look at the way theologians of liberation, and again here particularly from Latin America, read the scriptures. And this is Roman numeral 2 on the handout sheet. Right, reading the scriptures from the perspective of for whose good, or another phrase that is particularly predominant within Latin America is the phrase rereading the scriptures with the eyes of the poor. That becomes kind of operative phrase here, rereading the scriptures with, or sometimes they say, through the eyes of the poor. And to say, what do the scriptures then show us and teach us and tell us? And again, I've tried to give a number of different passages in that, and you can look at those. We certainly don't have time to look at all of them here, but to look at some of them. The first one, Exodus chapter 3, verses 7 to 22, which is the call of Moses in the book of Exodus. And again, how the Exodus becomes a paradigm for liberation for these theologians. And again, note here again, God is pictured as a deliverer. To look at verses 7 and 8 of chapter 3. And I'm reading from a Revised Standard Version. Verses 7 and 8 read, "Then the Lord said, I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, you know, all those ites." Okay. All right? "But that I have seen their affliction, heard their cry, and what? I have come down to deliver them." That key term here translated as deliver, at times can be translated as save, as liberation. It has with that all those connotations. Or again, to look at verses 19 and 20, or 19 through 22, right, to get a better understanding of the context here in chapter 3 of the book of Exodus, beginning at verse 19. I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. I mean, liberation is never an easy thing. So I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all the wonders which I will do in it. After that he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty. But each woman shall ask of her neighbor and of her who sojourns in her house jewelry of silver and of gold and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. Thus you shall despoil the Egyptians. And the reason I read this particular section is because, again, I think most of us, when we read verses 7 and 8, you know, we're always there cheering the Hebrews on. Yay, go Yahweh, go Hebrews, boo Egyptians, right? Because, you know, go ahead, God, deliver them. Bring them up out of the land of Egypt. But that too exacts its price, right? The Egyptians pay a heavy price for that. They lose gold and silver and jewelry and property and commodities and goods. Liberation isn't nice, particularly from the Egyptians' point of view. Liberation is indeed a blessing from the Hebrews' perspective. And so again, that, you know, that notion of deliverance cuts both ways. And we have to keep that in consideration.
And then what about the Canaanites and the Hittites and Amorites? Liberation to all, it becomes justification to oppress them?
No, it does not become justification to oppress them, right? I mean, here again is where we have, as we look further within the scriptures, the notions, for example, like in the book of Micah, right? The prophet Micah says, right, do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. Liberation does not simply mean to invert the oppressor-oppressed cycle, so that oppressors become oppressed and oppressed become oppressors. Right, that is a vicious circle. That is not the goal. That's not their understanding. But it's always a danger. That's again why all action needs critical reflection. That's why Israel always needs God's prophets to call them into line, to tell them to remember the covenant and remember God's mercy and to do justice and to act toward the neighbor as God has always acted toward the people. And that's the prophetic call. One other way of expressing liberation from this first section, if we would look at Deuteronomy chapter 26. And Deuteronomy chapter 26, at the beginning here, is an instruction that says, when you come into the land and take possession of it, the first fruits that you receive you are to give as an offering to God. And then in verses 5 and following of chapter 26 is the prayer which the person making the offering is to recite. And I'd like to look at that prayer for a moment. In verse 5 it reads, and you shall make response before the Lord your God. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us and laid upon us hard bondage. Then we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great terror, with signs and wonders, and he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground, which thou, O Lord, hast given me. And then the instructions continue. And you shall set it down before the Lord your God and worship before the Lord your God. What I think is particularly interesting here, and what others have noted as well, is the shift in pronouns. Note at first, a wandering Aramean was my father. He went down to Egypt. But after he got into Egypt, what happens in verse 6? The Egyptians treated us harshly, afflicted us, laid upon us hard. All of a sudden, from third person, first person plural, it's us, right? We, those people, are brought into that situation of remembering our oppression and also of remembering our liberation, and how that liberation is not something that just happens back then, but is the constant, continuing, ongoing work and activity of God. And we need to think about that. And then note how it zeroes in more significantly, if you will, in verse 10. And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit, which thou, O Lord, hast given me. So from he to us to I. That process of deliverance and liberation is something which always involves me. It is immediate, it is contemporary, it is personal, and yet it is also collective, right? The us, the community, the group. And so all of those components are at work and must be considered when we think about who God is, how God acts as a deliverer, and for whom is God good. God is good for us. Section B talks about the prophets. They're called a covenant faithfulness and justice. I've cited a little bit the passage from Micah, noted some others in Isaiah, Jeremiah. I'd like to move on, for the sake of time, to the New Testament. And here, first of all, to look at Mark. And in Mark's gospel, we see some of the healing miracles and the teaching of Jesus. Both are always together in Mark's gospel. And to look at simply one incident within this section from the Gospel of Mark, and that would be Mark chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. One story of healing on the Sabbath. And again, from the RSV it reads, Jesus entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. And they watched him to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And in the Greek word for accuse is also, for us in the English language, it can be transliterated into the word categorize, right? So so here we see that the religious authorities are watching Jesus so that they can categorize him, right? Place him on the list. Is he one of us? Or is he one of them? Is he on the side of the state, of the oppressors, of the dominators, or is he on the side of those others, those troublemakers, the crowds, the peasants, the poor, right? Categorizing. And immediately, I mean, just thinking in the press, whatever news releases you may read, whether it be Central America or other countries of Latin America, countries on the African continent, immediately everyone has to be categorized, put in their right places, and particularly put in their right places in terms of so we know if they're good or bad, friend or enemy, trustworthy, untrustworthy. That whole categorization goes on. Right? Are they for democracy or are they godless commies? Right? Gotta categorize them. Jesus responds. He says to the man who had the withered hand, "Come here." And he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?" Right? Note the way the question is put. Right? For whose good? And earlier in the story of plucking grain on the Sabbath, again, the question comes up, right? For whose good? Right? For whose good is the Sabbath? Right? Did God institute the Sabbath as another law that we all have to obey? And if we don't, God will condemn us? Or is the Sabbath another one of God's gifts and blessings to us, so that on that day there is rest, there is shalom, there is time to reflect upon who God is and what God does for us, God the deliverer, the liberator? And so these issues again, what's to go on here? Are we to do good to save life? Or to harm, to kill? But they were silent. Right? And they were silent not just because they were a bunch of dummies and didn't know the answer. Particularly here, if you look at Mark's gospel, whenever he uses the word silent, like back in chapter 1, it's when he tells the demon coming out of the person, "Be silent." Or when Jesus stills the storm in Mark chapter 4 and tells the storm, "Be silent." In Mark's gospel, silence is always connected with the side of the demonic, of the forces of chaos, of the forces that would oppress and would keep people from God's grace and kindness and deliverance. And so here again, when these people are silent, Mark is giving us an indicator whose side they are on. It is not the side of good and of saving life. And because of that, right, Jesus looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. Note how both of those things at the same time. Anger and grief. A sense of compassion and also that sense of indignation at injustice. Not in accommodation with evil. And Jesus says to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him how to destroy him. Right. Again, a different word than earlier had been used in Jesus' question to save life or to kill. Right. You've got to up the ante. A person like Jesus, a friend of sinners, one who is a deliverer or a liberator, must be destroyed. You see, it's not enough to kill them. An example one would use is our Archbishop Oscar Romero. Right? It's not enough to kill him, because what he stands for and what he and to that which he witnesses is more powerful than that one person is. And so to simply kill Archbishop Oscar Romero does nothing. You've got to destroy him and his witness and that for which he stands. And so too for Jesus. It's not enough to try to kill him. Right? If you will, the theology of the cross and the crucifixion demonstrate that that wasn't a very good solution. Right? Killing Jesus wasn't enough. One must try to destroy that message of deliverance. And because that message of deliverance is God's message of deliverance, right, it cannot be destroyed. That becomes the powerful thing. That is what gives the people within the third world countries hope. Yes, they will be killed, but not destroyed. And why will they not be destroyed? Because God cannot be destroyed. The cross and resurrection of Christ are testimony to that. And it is that which empowers them to continue their witness and keeps them working for peace and justice and freedom and love of neighbor. Okay. Another example. Luke chapter 19. What does liberation mean for the rich? Well, here's what it means. It's the Zacchaeus story. And Jesus enters Jericho. Zacchaeus is there. The description of Zacchaeus, understatement, but everyone knows what's going on here in verse 2. And there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and rich. You don't have to say any more because you know how chief tax collectors get their money. Right? Through hard work. Right? Okay, we can keep going. He sought to see Jesus, but he couldn't. He was of small stature and so on and so forth. Jesus comes along, right, and says at the last half of verse 5, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down. I must stay at your house today. Right? Zeke, we're doing lunch, so get it ready. And Zacchaeus comes down and receives him joyfully. Right? And again, that murmuring, right? He has gone in to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. Right? But note what happens again when that rich Zacchaeus is confronted with the good, liberating news of Jesus. Verse 8, Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold." More than was legally necessary for any kinds of fraud. Zacchaeus makes sure that the justice and equity in things have been restored. And Jesus' response in verse 9, "Today salvation has come to this house." And again, that term for salvation, one can read, "Today liberation has come to this house. Today deliverance has come to this house. Since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." One more from Luke's Gospel here. Again, third world or Latin American interpretation. This is from number 4, Luke 20, verses 19 to 26. Sets the whole context here again about the scribes, chief priests, trying to lay hands on Jesus. They're afraid of the people, so on and so forth. And so they try to trick him by asking the question. I'll begin at verse 21. They ask him, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach rightly and show no partiality." You see, that that already there is so much truth in that statement, even though it seems to, you know, ooze irony. But you see, that's just the problem with Jesus. He shows no partiality. Right? He shows that he can be a friend of sinners, a friend to a Zacchaeus. That's why he's got to be destroyed. That's those kinds of talk for freedom and justice and for all is problematic. But you show no partiality, but truly teach the way of God. Is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their craftiness and said to them, "Show me a coin. Whose likeness and inscription has it?" They said, "Caesar's." He said to them, "Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." Now, we usually stop there and say, see, look at here now we have a wonderful proof text about why good Christians should always pay their taxes. Right? But let's just first of all look at the next verse. And they were not able in the presence of the people to catch him by what he said. But marveling at his answer, they were silent. Right? That kind of connotation again of silence with the side of the demonic and the diabolical. But again, why in the presence of the people couldn't they catch him? Because the people, when they hear Jesus saying, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's," are cheering wildly. Because think again, we have what? Romans as conquerors in a land that certainly, from the position of the Hebrew people, does not belong to Rome. And so when you think about that, rendering to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, what does Caesar deserve?
Nothing.
Anyone?
Nothing.
Nothing. Caesar gets the Bronx cheer. Right? That's what you render to Caesar. Nothing. And he said, "Oh, come on, that can't be the interpretation." Well, look at Luke chapter 23, verses 1 and 2. Jesus is before Pilate. And at that time, as the charges are brought against Jesus, what are they saying? Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man perverting our nation, and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ the King." Forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar. Now, where would they have gotten an idea like that? Because Jesus said, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's." And everyone understood clearly what belongs to Caesar. And so too, within the situation of domination and oppression, within Latin America and other countries and situations like that, render to the dominating oppressive powers what belongs to the dominating oppressive powers. Nothing. That's why they're perverting the nation. That's why they're subversive. That's why they're problematical. That's why to be a Lutheran in El Salvador is synonymous with being treasonous and communist and traitor and draft dodger and subversive and everything else. Because they question the authority of that. Yes, Bruce.
I don't know a whole lot about liberation theology, but two questions keep popping in my mind, and maybe you can help answer those. Proponents of liberation theology, how do they answer, or not answer, but how do they deal with the fact that many times those who were to be delivered ended up not being delivered? And I'm thinking of, in the Exodus, those that were brought out of Egypt, we read later on, many did not receive the actual liberation pain and so forth? That's the one question I have. And the second one is also in the New Testament, we think of people like the Roman centurion or Nicodemus, who came out of the Roman centurion coming out of the Romans, and then Nicodemus coming out of the Sanhedrin and this sort of thing. How does that fit into liberation theology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two good questions. The first question, to answer with another question, to say, why is it that we, who in faith know what God in Christ has done for us, has suffered, died, risen again for us, we who know that, why would we want to go out and oppress people, dominate people, pollute our earth, on and on? What's the matter with us? What happens? Right. The theological answer to that, right, one word, sin. Right. And liberation theology, and these theologians here, you know, do not misunderstand them in terms of, they're not trying to romanticize the poor and the oppressed. I mean, to be poor doesn't mean that you're that much closer to heaven. Right. In fact, to be poor and to be stuck within poverty probably means if you're hungry, you're going to lie and cheat and steal and do anything you can and rationalize it away so that you can survive. And still, right, the contention is, and God is on their side. Right, so they're not trying at all to deny sin. Right, again, the kind of thing is, how could it be that the Hebrew people, who have seen and witnessed God's liberating grace in bringing them out of Egypt, would construct the golden calf, would doubt and not have faith and complain and murmur about God? Right? Sin is the answer to that. And so that, again, is the way the theologians of liberation handle that too. What about those who are not poor? A Nicodemus or a Zacchaeus or something like that. Here again, their response to that is, indeed, God comes to all people. But the address to those who are rich is the address to take the side of the poor. In other words, note Zacchaeus' action. Note Nicodemus' action. Right. As you see, what is he doing on, at least for example, in John's Gospel, where Nicodemus is brought up? Right. What is he doing on Good Friday? He is one of the few who comes forward to take Jesus down from the cross. Right. And again, an indication on whose side Nicodemus now is, and the life-changing results that happens from that.
Just a question that's always rather amusing to me is, what do these formerly poor people do now that they've got this loop of Nicodemus and everybody else? What do they do now they are no longer so-called poor?
Okay, we'll take a look here.
Someone below them they can point it off onto, but money seems to be pretty hot.
Yeah, well, there's...
unloaded.
No problem there. Acts chapter 2. One of the places we can look at that. And it again comes in Acts chapter 4. But we'll look at Acts chapter 2. This is after Peter preaches a barn burner of a Pentecost sermon and the results of that. And I'll begin at verse 43 and following. And fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done through the apostles. And all who believed were together and had all things in common. And they sold their possessions and goods and distributed them to all as any had need. And day by day attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they partook of food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved. Right. Here we have the idea, right? And again, not to minimize the fact that sin and self-centeredness and selfishness sets in. But the ideal here is that people are taken care of, as it says in verse 45, as any had need. Right. The understanding here of deliverance and liberation is that one takes care of needs. So that there's a balance. We're not talking here, the concern is not about the haves and the have-nots. But the Christian understanding of love of neighbor is to make sure everyone has enough. And I'm sure you've heard these kinds of things before. There's enough food in the world to feed everybody. Right? The problem, quote unquote, is distribution. But the problem is deeper than distribution. Right? The problem is politically and economically and everything within structure such that the haves want to keep what they have, and that means that the have-nots continue to have less. And that's the kind of thing where it comes back on us very hard in terms of we live well because many others in the world do not. And if we want to continue to live well, we have to make sure that many others in the world do not. And that now becomes the challenge for us in terms of, so you think you're Christian. How are you exercising love of God and love of neighbor?